We are so lucky to live in Wisconsin, aren't we? We have incredible natural areas, and the wildlife that lives in them are really fascinating to observe and to learn about. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this week for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are really fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven come by regularly to share what he's been seeing and to help us understand what's going on out there. And Scott, always great to see you.
It's great to be back.
Having a good summer?
So far, so good. The disturbing thing is I realize it's only like 4 weeks to Labor Day.
But you're retired.
Well, that's true, but that doesn't stop the seasons from changing.
No,
that's
but it means a little something.
It means a little something, but I enjoy fall greatly anyway, so that's fine with me. But we've had some pretty nice weather lately.
This is kind of perfect weather, as far as I'm
concerned. It's really
good.
If we could somehow knock the mosquito population back in the North Woods, which has been coming and going, but I've been up there for a couple of the comings rather than goings, and oh my gosh, they're just brutal.
Well, and they were also saying it's been a really bad year for black flies too, right?
Yeah, the black flies were a problem. They were a problem for nesting loons and a problem for people and probably other wildlife. And that will all pass, but it's been a ferocious year for biting insects.
Well, you recently led a small mammal field trip with the Wisconsin Natural Resources Foundation. And tell us about that. What were you looking for and what did you find?
Well, this was this past Saturday. I'm a board member now on the foundation and wanted to get involved in the field trip, so we cobbled together this new one on small mammals under the theory that, as far as most folks are concerned, and I think we can include most of our listeners too, if it's furry and smaller than a squirrel, it's just some kind of mouse. And it's a lot more complicated than that. We have some really neat small mammals in the state. They often go unnoticed, or even if they're noticed, no one pays much attention. And I think that's unfortunate because some of them actually need some conservation attention. They're an important prey base for lots of stuff bigger than they are, and they can have tremendous impacts on our homes, gardens, forest floor, and so forth. So lots of interesting stuff. And in reality, whether it's a shrew or a mole or a bat or a mouse or whatever, these little guys on a daily basis have to do everything that a black bear or a white-tailed deer or a wolf has to do. So they're out there looking for food, looking for mates, looking for shelter, trying to avoid being eaten, and yet they're right there in people's backyards in incredible abundance. Anyway.
So where did you do the field trip?
So the field trip started out here on campus
in our
teaching laboratory where I have all the specimens, and we went through 30-some species that qualify as small mammals, meaning small in their adult form.
Mm-hmm.
We all start out small at some point, but
we're all small mammals at some point.
But we went through the specimens and some identification tips and skull characteristics and natural history. And then we all caravaned out to my home in the town of Oregon. And I had set out I didn't think it was a very extensive trap line of Sherman live traps and some box traps and so forth, hoping we'd catch a couple things that they could then see alive and learn how to handle and whatnot. In those 35 traps, we caught 22 individual animals, which was amazing because not only were the traps not that numerous, but I was fighting the storms that night and the mosquitoes to get them set, so I was in a hurry. So the placement wasn't that great, and they were the wrong size traps, or at least I thought they were.
Wow.
But
you really got lucky.
Everywhere we went, oh, there's another trap closed, and sure enough. Now, most were white-footed mice or deer mice, collectively referred to as paramiscus or field mice, and a chipmunk and a 13-line ground squirrel, and we saw a few other odds and ends. But if that trap success was any indication, and my restored prairie is indicative of habitat in southern Wisconsin, then the forces have come together for the perfect storm of small mammals. And the importance of that is that people ought to beware going into fall that if this really is a high year for paramiscus and for voles, like the meadow vole or meadow mouse, as it's often called, then that doesn't bode well for protecting landscape plants and animals getting into homes and things like that come colder weather. So people should be on the lookout on their own property. I know I'm sensitized
now
to the issue
right now.
Now
you're very well aware.
So I'm plotting my strategy for the fall. But I think that people really enjoyed seeing these little things.
Mm-hmm.
and realizing that there's a lot of stuff out there on the landscape that people don't pay a great deal of attention to.
Interesting. So there are a few other things coming up that you want to let people know about. You're doing a snake program.
Well, if anybody happens to be in Bailey's Harbor or on the Door Peninsula tomorrow night, I'll be at the Ridges Sanctuary Thursday night lecture series doing a snake program at the town hall at 7 o'clock. So anybody's welcome to come by there and hopefully learn a little bit about snakes. And then in the Madison area on Saturday, we have a farm open house at West Madison out on Mineral Point Road at that UW farm. And I think there'll be quite a few extension folks there in the tents. I'll be talking about the aforementioned small mammals and protecting yards and gardens and things. But also, if people are so inclined, how to attract some of these things to their yard or property. And next week, of course, is Farm Technology Days.
And where is that going on this year?
It's in it's just south of Stevens Point. So it's in central Wisconsin. It's easy to get to. I'm sure there'll be big crowds. And I'm undecided about my attendance at this point. When I start to talk about all these things that's going on, I'm saying, gee, I thought I retired.
Right.
But, anyway, if the weather's conducive to sitting in the tent all day, I'll probably go along for a day or two. If not, then...
It's still a good event, though.
It's a great event, and whether I'm there or not, David and Jamie, whom people are getting to know on the radio as well, will be there. So there will be a wildlife display and some stuff to see.
And the state fair is going on.
And there are a few days left of the state fair, and although we have no extension presence over there this year, the DNR has revamped and really, I think, upgraded there. It was always one of the most popular sites on on the fairgrounds. It was kind of a green oasis to get away from everything else and just take a break from stuffing in cream puffs for a few minutes. But it's always been a popular venue for license sales, for kids' activities, and again, a place to just see something other than, you know, Midway kind of sights and sounds, as well as a lot of educational exhibits and a chance to talk to DNR folks from all the different disciplines. So that's still going on, and if you happen to be going to State Fair, stop by.
And you can have a cream puff, too.
Yes, you can have one in each hand if you want.
We are talking with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist and emeritus wildlife specialist with the UW Extension. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And going back to those small mammals, Scott, Amy emailed and said, can Scott discuss the differences between moles, voles, and mice, looks, and maybe behavior?
Yes, we'll try and squeeze that in before noon. So talking about small mammals, as I said, we're talking about things that are, in the neighborhood of mouse or chipmunk size or smaller, and that's as large as they get. There are a few animals that are kind of excluded from the list. A least weasel, for example, is about the right size, but since it's a member of a larger family of mammals, which are generally larger, all the weasels, we kind of rule that one out. And we rule out baby animals. So we're left with moles, of which there are two, bats, of which there are eight, and they're kind of a separate case too. We've talked a lot about bats on the program. Shrews, of which there are half a dozen. Voles, of which there are five.
Wow.
Mice, seven. A rat, a pocket gopher, and a few miscellaneous ground squirrels. And probably a few other things we could throw in too. But the upshot is the box score then is up in the low 30s for these so-called small mammals, which is about half of the mammalian fauna of the state.
Really?
So all the big stuff at the other end, the wolves and deer and bear, they get all the press and all the attention and interest, but these little guys are far more common. I mean, for voles, for example, in a good year like this seems to be, there could be 1,000 or more per acre of grassy habitat.
Wow.
Whereas you measure the number of wolves or bears per square mile. So anyway, they're abundant. They're generally unprotected. In other words, you can take steps to protect yourself from some of the negative things they do. But it also means you can catch one in a live trap and put it in a terrarium to take some pictures of it and let it go again or look at it, show it to the kids, whatever, without fear of legal issues. And they're very widely distributed. So there's a lot of them out there. Now, in terms of the differences, the moles and the shrews are linked together by being or belonging to two separate families within the same order of mammals are called insectivores. They are not rodents.
Hmm.
Neither are bats. Bats are in their own order. Shrews and moles are in their own order. The rest are all rodents. Whether they're ground squirrels, mice, voles, whatever, they're rodents. About 40% or so of all the world's mammals are rodents. So they're the most common ones, and they're the ones that are typified by those two big stained incisor teeth in the upper and lower part of their jaw. So if you look at a beaver skull, mm-hmm. for example, those four great big orange teeth that look like teeth off a chainsaw blade are, and that's how they work too, are very distinctive. The moles and shrews, on the other hand, have a mouthful of tiny, sharp little teeth that, if they were enlarged to the size of a wolf skull, would put a wolf to shame by dentition. And their food base is primarily animal material, whereas the rodents, primarily plant material. Now, there are no absolutes when it comes to these things. Ground squirrels, like the little striped guys mm-hmm. we see running around this time of year, will readily snag a fledgling bird if they can get a hold of it, and it makes a fine meal for them. Conversely, a shrew or mole might occasionally duck out of the snow in the winter and grab a sunflower seed under your feeder. But the characteristics, then, that fit those groups, the dentition or tooth structure is very different. Size-wise, there are a lot of things that are mouse size, hence the, oh, it's a mouse. But generally speaking, the moles are typified as great big front feet. They're...
Because they're diggers.
They're diggers. They're fossorial, as it's called. They spend most of their time, all their time underground, and they dig like crazy. So they have very enlarged front feet and claws. There's a star-nosed mole and the common
mole. Those are crazy
looking. The star-nosed mole is a crazy looking thing.
It looks like a Dr. Seuss character.
Or something that Steven Spielberg came up with for a Star Wars
yeah,
episode.
It really does.
But yet they're right here in Wisconsin, so you don't have to imagine some weird-looking animal mm-hmm. found in Central Africa. We've got weird stuff right here. So the star-nosed mole is pretty cool. They spend a lot of their time in the water, and the common mole spends all its time making little mounds in your backyard. That's another story. Shrews tend to be tiny, ranging from two of them that are about the size of my little finger up to the water shrew, which is about mouse size, has a long tail. Four of the shrews have long tails. Four have long tails. Two have very short tails. The most common one that anybody's going to run into is one called a short-tailed shrew. It's about mouse size, dark charcoal gray, stubby little tail about the length of its hind foot, and a pointed muzzle. Their claim to fame, and I pointed out that they're very common, they're in everybody's yard, garage, what have you, they're venomous. So, don't lose any sleep tonight. Oh, my God, there are venomous shrews in the yard. If you are bitten by one because you've grabbed it or mishandled it, yes, it's going to hurt. Your hand may get stiff for a day, or you'll have a sore arm if you're bitten on an extremity, but it's not life-threatening.
And so it's just the bite that has that?
The saliva contains the venom. And the reason for that, from an evolutionary standpoint, is these little shrews that are the same size as mice eat mice, among other things. So the venom helps them subdue a prey item, which is as big or bigger than they are.
But for instance, if, say, a crow eats one of those shrews, the venom is not going to affect them.
No problem. I was going to say unfortunately, but I don't think that's kind of a human attribute. Cats will readily bring shrews home and patooey, spit them out on the kitchen floor. The assumption is, well, they must taste lousy, but I have no proof of that one way or the other.
Well, we'll expect you to do your own experiment on that, Scott, and report back next month.
That experiment has been done, but I'm reluctant to report on it. So anyway.
All right. Well, thanks for that question, Amy, and for all that great information, Scott. Ray emailed that in years past, he said they would see a few red squirrels in the yard in the fall. For the last 3 years, it's not rare to see 12 or 15 at a time. He says they also got into my shed and destroyed so many things. They live near Eau Claire, and the area has not changed much in the last several years. Why would there be such an increase in the red squirrel population?
Well, like any animal population, these animals respond well to changes in winter conditions or spring weather or what have you. which in turn affects the plant community. So in a good nut year, for example, when there's a big acorn crop, the frosts have all aligned properly, then all of a sudden squirrel populations of all kinds, boom, the reproductive potential of these little guys is pretty amazing. So they can respond very quickly to, ooh, there's a good food supply, ooh, the predator numbers are down in our area, oh, the weather's great, whatever. They can respond to that very quickly numerically. So that's probably part of it. Others in the group are somewhat cyclic in their population abundance by nature. The voles, for example, like the common meadow vole that makes the little ridges you see in your lawn when the snow melts in the spring, those tend to occur and become abundant on about a four-year on average cycle. So they're monitored by the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection because they cause all sorts of problems for Christmas trees and other such commodities. Red squirrels, not so much on the cyclic stuff, but in a given area, the kind of response that the caller's seeing could be explained by half a dozen different things.
All right. We are talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And you can always post a question, comment, or wildlife photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in this week for Larry Mueller, Carl Christensen, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven about Wisconsin's wonderful wildlife and talking with you. Let's go to the phone, Scott, and Nick in Green Bay is up first. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Judith. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. My question, actually a comment real quick and then two questions. My comment is my daughter's favorite thing to do at night is we have a campfire and she wants to go in the woods and see what animals we can find, which is really awesome.
Oh, that's great.
That's cool.
Yeah, and then the other thing is I know we got flying squirrels because I heard them. I didn't know the call, so I looked it up, and sure enough, it's flying squirrels.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to put a bird feeder up where I can actually view them at night.
Yep.
And the other question I got for you real quick is, I want to put a bat house up, but I was wondering how long it takes for a colony to actually establish in a bat house.
That's a question without an answer, Nick. As far as the bat houses are concerned, if you get a good design, whether you make it yourself or buy it, so you have a good bat house that has the right spacing of the interior baffles and everything's good on that front, and you place it in the best possible location in terms of height and aspect and building and not on a tree and all that kind of stuff, then occupancy rates are in the neighborhood of maybe 50%. You can manipulate that by either hedging your bets by putting up a couple houses, or seeding the houses a little bit with some bat droppings if you can find those in an abandoned building or attic or someone who has an active bat house. So there are a couple of tricks, but no guarantee. The occupancy rate is better than, say, trying to put up a purple martin colony box right now, but no guarantee that you'll get bats right off the bat, so to speak. How about that one? But again, if you've done everything right in terms of house selection and placement, you should know within a couple of years whether you're going to get them or not.
And I will point out that there's an annual bat festival in Wisconsin.
That's right. It's coming up soon.
Well, it's often in Madison, but this year it's going to be in Milwaukee, and it is Friday, October 3rd through Sunday, October 5th. There will be events in multiple locations, and I'm actually going to be emceeing some of the activities on Saturday the 4th. So you can just Google Wisconsin Bat Festival 2014 and get lots of great information there.
It's just one quick thing on the flying squirrel issue. If you're going to put up a feeder, they really like a flat shelf type feeder, just basically a board or a piece of plywood with enough of a lip on it to hold some seeds in. And then they can glide into that and glide off of it pretty easily. And if they're just starting to come in and seem a little nervous, if you've got a floodlight or something you're going to watch them with, put a red filter in it or a red bulb, and that is less disturbing to them. But eventually, they'll become quite tame. You can go with a main floodlight, and they'll be there almost constantly. So good luck with that.
Thanks.
Yep.
Thanks, Nick. And Mary posted a photo on the Facebook page, found lots of these salamanders on our property on big crawling stone. Haven't seen them since the 80s. Can you tell what kind of salamander that is?
Yes, it looks like it's kind of hard to tell the scale, but I'm assuming that that's a normal size board in the background.
Right.
So it looks like a blue spotted salamander, which is a pretty common so-called mole salamander. You can kind of see the little rib indentations on them. And they're related to tiger salamanders and spotted salamanders and so on, which are much larger. Mary can respond, I guess, if necessary, but I'm guessing that individual's probably no more than 5 or 6 inches long at best. So, blue spotted salamander.
All right, nice picture.
Thanks for
sharing that with us, Mary. You can share wildlife photos on the Facebook page. Also, questions and comments there. Let's go back to the phones and Ben in Wausau. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well.
Great program. I've got a question that's probably very timely. The last couple nights, a critter has been digging in my lawn, pushing small amounts of sod aside. And my questions are, what's going on? Who might be doing it? And is there anything I can do to stop it? And I'll take your answers off the air.
All right. Thanks for that call, Ben.
Wow, Ben, you're in big trouble. just kidding. There's two likely culprits for the problem. The big trouble, actually, I only brought up because you do need to try and nip it in the bud, because if it's raccoons, they can make a yard look almost rototilled, depending on how the sod, if it was actually laid as sod, or especially if it's newer sod, they can literally roll it right back up. Like,
and are they looking for grubs,
truck.
Or what are they
looking for? We've had pretty good soil moisture this year, so they don't mess around in a dry year, because the grubs and earthworms are down deep enough where the digging isn't going to do anything for them. But if things are near the surface, which they probably are, I mean, most people got a pretty good rain in the last few days, some didn't, but most did, then it's either raccoons or skunks. And there's a couple ways you can figure this out. You can either buy, borrow, or otherwise obtain a couple of live traps, good box traps, tomahawk, have a heart, whatever you can find, and bait those and put them out there. And no raccoon can resist a live trap baited with marshmallows especially, but cat food will work too, and cat food will also catch the skunk. The problem, of course, is if it is skunks and you catch a skunk, you've got another set of difficulties to deal with, but we can walk you through that if it happens. The less invasive way to do it is, again, if you have one or can borrow one, put out a trail camera. And just wherever the damage is, drive a stake in the ground, wire the camera up, set it, and you should have really good pictures of whoever the culprit is by the next morning.
And then you can tailor your response.
Then, once you know who it is, you can either deal with the raccoon by trapping. You're probably going to trap either way, but if it proves to be skunks, you may want to hire somebody who has the right traps and knows how to deal with a trapped skunk. But those are the two likely suspects. The indirect way to do it is to apply some type of pesticide to the lawn or turf that will take care of the grubs or drive the worms down. But the response time to that is slow enough that you're going to have more damage than you want to deal with before the application. We used to use diazinon, for example. That's no longer on the market, but I think a good garden center could sell you an alternative. So, a couple options.
Thanks for that call. Brenda emailed, does barn lime help get rid of moles?
It might, but there are some really good products just on the market the last 6 or 8 years that rely on castor oil, and there are a lot of different trade names. Mole Med was the original one, and there's a bunch of others now. And if you go on the internet and type in mole repellent and search it, you can actually find a recipe to make it yourself. All of those things will generally just drive the moles either down or away for a month or six weeks or 2 months if you're lucky, depending on how much rain has been falling that washes the stuff into the soil. But I think rather than experiment with things that are kind of iffy, or you can try a patch and see what happens. If you have access to the product and it's not going to do something detrimental to the lawn or pets or whatever else, be careful with that kind of thing. but try it out. But the castor oil repellents seem to work, and other people swear by the fact that if you learn how to use a commercial mole trap, you can really put an end to the damage. There's not as many moles as the kind of damage you might be seeing usually suggests.
All right. And another email before we go back to the phones. Priscilla asks, I've seen chipmunks, the striped kind, eating dead birds. Is that common behavior?
Yes. In fact, driving back from Mount Horeb to Madison the other night, there was something dead right in the middle of the road, and there was a ground squirrel sitting there chewing away, and he came close to being added to the roadkill. But yes, as I mentioned earlier, talking about the ground squirrels, they can all be surprisingly carnivorous at times.
So they're pretty much opportunistic.
They're pretty much opportunistic. They'll eat what they can find. And if roadkill is readily available or on the menu, then that's what they'll eat.
Talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven today, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Let's go back to the phones and Terry in Green Bay. Hi, Terry.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call,
sure.
Judith. And hope you're having a good retirement, Scott.
So far, so good.
Great. Glad to hear it. Observation, there are a lot of baby little things are out there, squirrels, rabbits. And I've been seeing a lot of second, third breeds of ducks.
Mm-hmm.
And my question, and asking about your strategy, the upcoming teal season, early teal season,
mm-hmm.
How does an ethical sports person, other than not going hunting, avoid shooting a lot of the young, not fully plumaged other ducks other than teal?
Hmm. Great question.
Well, it's a very good question, and there was a lot of apprehension about approving an early teal season, which will start this year. I think it's a 3-year experiment by the Fish and Wildlife Service and the DNR, but it will open on September 1st and run only till the 7th. 6-bird daily bag limit, and opening begins at 9 a.m. on the first day. Those are kind of the particulars. But the only ducks legal for harvest during that experimental teal season will be blue-winged and green-winged teal. Now, if you have one in the hand, this seems pretty easy. You know, blue-winged teal's got a blue wing patch, and a green-winged teal's got the green speculum on the wings and so on. But you're dealing with drakes, which are fairly easy to identify, hens, which are less so. But the bottom line is they're small, fast-flying ducks, and anyone who has a bit of experience with waterfowl hunting shouldn't have a problem with that. A beginner or someone who just, wow, we can hunt ducks in 1st of September, let's go give it a try, there is some concern over that. So whoever is going to take advantage of this early teal hunting opportunity really should do their homework. There are plenty of websites that offer video identification, field guides that offer static pictures, I suspect through Ducks Unlimited or the local DNRs or whatever. There are all sorts of opportunities to brush up on your skills. And then at that point, prior to going hunting, since scouting is always a good idea anyway, you need to find a good spot, go sit in this spot for a few days before the actual season. Just sit there and see what's flying by, and try and hone your skills a bit. There's an interesting, in the current edition of the DNR's magazine, Wisconsin Natural Resources, the August issue, on page 19, there's a nice little feature called Try Your Hand at Teal Hunting, which talks about those ID issues, and also an opportunity to take a quiz on the DNR website. So the onus is on the hunters to not mess this up. If I'm fearful that if all of a sudden, you know, the wardens will be out in force, as they should be, and if all of a sudden they're finding lots of other ducks being taken by mistake, ignorance, or whatever you want to call it, then I think the opportunity for the early teal season, as long as teal numbers are high on the continent, to be a long-term thing is going to be jeopardized. So it's a neat opportunity. They're fun to hunt, but everybody has to do it right.
Thanks for that call, Terry. Let's go back to the phones and Steve in Green Bay. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks, Scott, for finding time in your busy retirement to still do this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I've got a question about every once in a while I come across a small mammal dead along the bike trail here in Green Bay. And 90% of the time, it's either going to be a shrew or a mole. What is it about those that they don't get, whatever killed them, they weren't consumed?
Well, we were talking about that a little bit, and there seems to be, they have some scent glands, and of course, in the case of the short-tailed shrew, the little dark charcoal gray one, that venomous saliva may be in part come into play, but they are notorious for not being consumed, and I can't explain that. We alluded to doing a taste test, and in fact, during one lunch break in the department a few years ago, I don't know why we had them or why I had them, but we had some shrews, particularly short-tailed shrews, and several of my colleagues, not including myself,
of course not,
gave them a try, or at least licked them, to see if there was something obviously, oh, yuck, kind of thing that would cause a cat or some other presumably hungry predator to pass up a meal. And the consensus was, no, we don't taste anything awful, and they don't smell bad. So I have no answer for that, and I've never seen a suitable answer in a mammalogy text or a field guide. If anybody has any light to shed on this, please give us a call.
So were those shrews cooked or raw?
They were raw shrews, freshly dead shrews. But in any event, they are commonly simply left behind. The other issue, of course, is that in the case of the shrews, they've got an incredible metabolic rate. I mean, they are just going flat out 24/7 with brief periods of rest, and they, you know, it's said sometimes that they can literally almost die of fright, die of shock. They're constantly looking for food. So there may be some other things going on there, too, in your finds, Steve, but it's more likely something caught them and decided, I think I'll look for another snack.
It's interesting, Steve, because that's happened twice in the last week or so. In my driveway, I have found two shrews that were quite dead, but obviously, you know, had not been even chewed on or anything. They were just there.
Don't know. This will remain one of the great mysteries of nature that we continually uncover and reaffirm here on the program.
Well, thanks so much for that call, Steve. Let's go to Jen in Milwaukee. Hi, Jen.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. Well, I guess I'm going to start the controversy that seems to hit the show a lot whenever Scott Craven's on. I spotted a cougar, and it was in, of all places, Saukville, Wisconsin, which, for those who don't know, is only about 20 miles north of Milwaukee. I saw it off the freeway. I was about 60 to 80 feet away. I did not see the face of the creature, but all the other body traits and tail length and color and the shape of the head from a top view were absolutely cat and big. And I know the difference between a lynx and a bobcat and a cougar, and this was a cougar. I have very little doubt at all.
Scott?
And I just thought people who live in Milwaukee might be happy to know that there's cougars moving in.
Well, first of all, I mean, you seem to know what you're talking about. There's no reason to doubt the sighting. I've not heard, not that I'm on the top of the loop for these things anymore, but I've not heard of any recent cougar sightings. As you probably know, over the last 6-7 years, there have been 4 or 5 cats documented in Wisconsin by DNA testing, in some cases blood samples, photographs, and so forth. But the animals have all had genetic affiliations to populations in the Dakotas. They're, for the most part, young males that are dispersing. And for those animals, Wisconsin is just essentially a rest area on the interstate of movement, so to speak. And the fact that the animal was seen in Saukville, depending on how long ago that was, it could be literally hundreds of miles in another direction, probably south or east, the way most of them seem to move. So it's a cool sighting. I'd like to see one myself. I haven't. So from that standpoint, hey, you were pretty lucky. So that's cool. from a standpoint of whether the animal's anywhere near there and therefore poses any level of concern to folks, that's up for grabs.
Mm-hmm.
But they have been confirmed. They're still mighty scarce, so a sighting is an unusual thing. And there's always still the possibility that the party line that was common 10, 20 years ago was that most cougar sightings, if they were in fact cougars, were probably stemmed from captive individuals that had escaped, gotten away, been released, whatever. And that's always a possibility, too.
All right. Thanks for that call. And we had an email from Brian saying, what is going on with all the dead carp on the Rock River? He says, I live in Watertown on the river, and it's just nasty. Is this going to continue until winter?
I don't know, but I'm trying to think of where I saw something about carp control activities that this may be related to.
Well, maybe we can try to look that up on the break.
We can maybe find that out, but you know, there have been, DNR has run rough fish camps on the Rock River for years. What they're up to these days, or even if they're still in existence, I don't know. But certainly a dead, stinky 30-pound carp on the bank of the river is a messy situation, but I don't know what's going on there right now.
Daniel posted a really lovely photo on the Facebook page. He says it's a killdeer nest in a mowed field behind his friend's garage in Cameron. The friend flagged it and mowed around it for a month. He said they almost gave up on them, but one day there were four fuzzy brown golf balls. She must have held off on setting because he read that they have a typical game bird length incubation period of 21 to 23 days. The mother took them directly to the taller grass in fallow fields out back, and that they were cute chicks. And it's a really lovely photo of four fuzzy golf balls.
That's pretty cool.
So thanks for that photo. Let's go back to the phones and Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
My question for your guest is relating to chipmunks. I live here in Madison, Wisconsin, and I have several dozen chipmunks that are all white. And they look like albino chipmunks. I got a really close-up look to a couple because I was going to – they've torn up the yard pretty good, and I wanted to eliminate them, but I didn't know if they were very rare. I've never seen albino chipmunk before, and I thought if they're really rare, I'd hate to decimate the population, but they are really tearing up the yard, so I need to do something. So can you tell me if it's a rare thing to see albino chipmunks? And they're literally about half the size of a 13-striped ground squirrel. They're about half. They're a smaller type of ground squirrel. They're larger than a mouse, about twice the size of a mouse, but maybe half the size of a full-size 13-striped ground squirrel.
All right. Thanks
for that comment. Well, where are these in the state? Where are you located?
In Madison. In Madison proper. And there was recently a bunch of road construction across the street from the house. They put in a new road, and and ever since then, we've had a large population of everything moving into the yard out from the wooded area that they tore down.
Well, this summer, it seems like, just as an aside, it seems like the road construction across the street from everybody's house. But
right.
Nevertheless, well, this is sort of strange. Generally, I would describe the common eastern or gray chipmunk, which is the one we have around here, as being about the same size as a 13-line ground squirrel. So my first concern is really what you have there. As an animal, the white pelage aside. The other issue is if you've either caught one or gotten a really good look at them, is it clear that they have pink eyes? Because there are other conditions like leucistic individuals that result in them being white, but they have normal colored eyes.
They did have normal colored eyes. They didn't have the pink eye,
which
was this albino separation, which I thought was weird because it wasn't necessarily a pigment deficiency like albino.
Right.
Like an
right.
Albino
so
have.
Not a true
well,
albino.
So not a true albino. So what goes on in a local population that results in this, you know, as I said earlier, talking about small mammals, the intergenerational time and reproductive rate is such that genetic conditions can be spread or perpetuated pretty quickly. But I'm really curious as to what you have. That many of them in a small area is really pretty unusual, and I'm just I'm thinking about how we can sort of figure this out here. Let's see. I'll tell you what. Let me, if you could, can he email some information in that we could get here? Or
would
is
you
that
be able
possible?
To, yeah. Would you be able to email some information?
Mike? I guess if you could send me, you know, name and phone number and whatnot, I'll give you a call at some point, depending on where you are. And are we talking north, south, east, or west in terms of Madison?
East side of Madison, okay. On the far east side.
Well, I mean, there are some folks at the UW Zoology Museum, some me included, and potentially some DNR folks who would be curious enough about this to want to maybe have a look.
I actually called UW, one of the extensions, and asked someone up there about it a couple of weeks back, and they told me that it wasn't too uncommon. But I have never seen one, and the people I've talked to, no one else has actually even ever heard of one, so... I figured I'd call for a second opinion.
Common or uncommon is kind of a relative floating term, but you said you'd seen several dozen of these things, so you see more than one at a time.
Yeah, they just bred here obviously a few weeks back, and there was about a month and a half ago they were popping up all over in the yard. And
have you made?
There were seven or eight out on the top of the grass at one time, and the hawks have been doing a pretty good job of taking care of them. But them, along with the normal ground squirrels, have just taken over the yard.
Well, let me put you on hold, Mike, and we'll ask Carl to get your phone number, and then you and Scott can connect.
We'll try and sort this out because we'd need to get a specimen. Thank you.
All right. So hold on, Mike, and we are talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about Wisconsin's wildlife with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven today. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Mary in Lebanon next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm calling to give you information on the carp, dying carp.
Great.
It was in the Watertown paper last night. It's caused by koi, K-O-I, herpes virus. KHB, and it's the first time it's been detected in Wisconsin, and they figure that it will continue spreading downriver and so on. So, and they mentioned the Silver Creek in the Watertown area had a lot of dead carp. So,
all right. Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Mary. And actually, Carl, our on-air producer today, did look it up quickly online, and he found the same information that it is this koi herpes virus. It says the Department of Natural Resources officials say the koi herpes virus is not harmful to humans or other fish. However, caution is urged in handling affected carp because as they decompose, they become susceptible to multiple secondary bacterial infections that can cause human illnesses.
Well, koi, of course, are ornamental mm-hmm. fish in the carp family kind of thing, which is kind of interesting. I mean, other than a stinky mess, a lot of something that wipes out carp doesn't strike me as being a bad thing. So we've been trying to wipe out carp since they got here years ago. And if that moves downstream and gets rid of the jumping carp, silver carp, and south of us, then
right.
I don't
so,
know.
So, I mean, is there a possibility that this virus could actually be used against the invasive carp?
Oh, I have no idea, but that's what came to mind when I heard about it.
Wow.
Well, we'll see what happens.
We'll
but anyway,
happens.
We know what's killing them
yes.
at this point.
Yes. So, koi, K-O-I, herpes virus. Let's go back to the phones and Tom in Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. Going back to the shrews and the moles. Apparently, they aren't very good to eat, and things like cats, red fox, gray fox that are hunting the roads that people are walking or biking on, you're going to see little piles, and they will gather them up, and they will actually, sometimes it's not uncommon to see two, three at a time piled together by these critters. Your Starnose mole is also poisonous, and it has a neurotoxin, which basically paralyzes rather than kills.
Huh.
And so what he has is a chamber underground, and he will go and harvest earthworms and grubs and bite them and his saliva, and they will simply be paralyzed, and it's sort of like a refrigerator type thing. He's storing food for bad times.
Hmm.
So both of those don't taste very good. And as far as other critters eating them, something like a short-tailed shrew, well, from long-eared owl size up, barred owls, great horns, snowies, they will eat them, and there doesn't seem to be a problem. In going through thousands of solid owl pellets, I have never found a short-tailed shrew.
Oh, well, that's really
interesting. Mandibles or skull. And I have two records of solid owls catching a short-tailed shrew, and the shrew bit the solid on the foot, on the toe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and solid was dead.
Hmm.
So the smaller size.
And I don't know if solids learned to select not to eat those or what the story is, but it's amazing that you just don't find any short-tailed shrews. You find all the other shrews.
Yeah.
You know, cinereus and Hoyai and all those kind of things, but you never find a short tail.
All right. Well, thanks so much. That's really interesting information.
Good to know that the solid owls have figured out the situation, but that
they're too cute
kind of
to,
thing happens.
They're too cute to lose them.
That's right.
Kind of like you, Scott.
Yeah. Great.
Well, thanks for that call, Tom. And so there is a recent report out about the impact of roadkill. Scott, what were the findings of that?
Well, roadkill is just one of those unfortunate byproducts of our obsession with cars and moving around the landscape. It's just another example of human activity's impact on wildlife. And unfortunately, roadkill is a particularly ugly one because although some people show remorse, my wife is despondent when she runs over something or hits something and tries desperately to avoid it, but sometimes you can't.
Well, and sometimes you're putting yourself and others in even more danger if you try
right.
to avoid
well,
it.
Well, especially with bigger stuff. But it takes a tremendous toll of wildlife, but I think it's difficult to capture public concern over this issue because, what do you expect us to do? Stop driving? Stop driving 80 miles an hour? I mean, forget it. I mean, we can't do that. Well, anyway, this was the feature article, a review paper in the recent edition of the Journal of Wildlife Management. It was entitled Estimation of Bird Vehicle Collision Mortality on U.S. Roads. And they went through every study they could lay their hands on over the last dozen or more years and generated national estimates of vehicle mortality on birds. And they modeled some of this. Anyway, their estimate was that between 89 and 340 million birds die annually from vehicle collision on U.S. roads.
Annually. Wow.
And I'm just thinking there was an extrapolation here that it might even be worse than that. But let's just take a midpoint there of a couple hundred million. And then you add that on to collisions with communications towers, with people's windows, and, of course, the cat mortality we just love to talk about, and a whole host of other things that is really laid at our doorstep as people. And it's kind of creepy.
And that's just birds.
And that's just birds when you start to put all the turtles and frogs and, I don't know. I've often wondered, actually, just driving to and from our place up north, I leave with a clean windshield. I get there and I couldn't possibly count the number mm-hmm. of impacts with insects. I wonder if anybody, maybe next time Phil's on, has thought about, that's every car on
right.
every road killing literally thousands of insects in a day. There must be something going on there mm-hmm. too. But it's a pretty staggering problem, but it's one that we haven't made a whole lot of headway on over the years.
Is there anything that we can do either individually or as a society that would put a dent in that?
There are things when it comes to mammals, particularly large mammals, with crossings and underpasses, and signage and defensive driving and so forth, that may help a bit. But I fear that those are driven, again, no pun intended, those are driven more by people's concern about what's going to happen to them in a collision with a moose or an elk or a deer than necessarily what's going to happen to the animal. Mm-hmm. So there are a few things with mammals, but in terms of bird collisions where the bird may fly into you as opposed to you hitting it, or it happens so quickly
right.
that, no, there's nothing you can do. And as you pointed out earlier, the risk of doing something like, and covering your eyes or something. That's
or swerving.
Not, or swerving or yeah. whatever. That just makes this makes a bad situation worse. So, no, it's a very troubling thing in terms of wildlife conservation. But at least they're starting to put some sideboards on how big a problem mm-hmm. it is.
And so, if someone wanted to take a look at that study, is that available online? Or
yeah, I think if you go to the Wildlife Society website, which is wildlife.org, it's in the volume 78, the July 2014 issue of the Journal of Wildlife Management.
All right. So big impact, especially on our bird populations of roadkill. We're talking with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. He will be with us up until 12:30 today. We'll be taking a quick look at the news from NPR and WPR shortly. But just to kind of preview what we're going to be looking at, Scott, we're going to talk about fall hunting forecast and permits. I know we have some folks on the line who need some help around the house and garden to control some animals. And what else are we going to talk about in the last half hour?
Oh, gee, we could go back. There are still some of the groups of small mammals we haven't covered very, very thoroughly. There are some new DNR reports out on the status of some of our species. And I think just a general account of as summer slips away here, what are we going to start to see that are signs of fall? I'm sure we'll be able to fill our last 30 minutes.
All right. Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Specialist with UW Extension, with us until 12:30. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this week for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. We expect wildlife to do certain things at specific times of the year, but just like us, our animal neighbors can change their schedules because of weather or unexpected events in the area. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller this week. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wildlife ecologist Scott Craven is our guide to Wisconsin's wildlife and natural areas. Scott comes by once a month to talk about the cycles of nature in Wisconsin, and we're happy to have him with us today. Thanks, as always, for spending time with us, Scott.
You're welcome.
And we had a question from Bob in Rostock. Can you address the new deer hunting regulations? And I know that's something that you wanted to cover.
the short answer is no, because there's a lot to deal with. But I would refer folks to a couple of different things. There's if I can find what I did with it here. There's a new. So let's just say first, there are major quantum changes in deer regulations for this year, all brought about by the acceptance of most of the recommendations, if not all, from the so-called deer czar or deer trustee.
And that's been a
couple
of years.
Been a couple of years ago since Dr. Kroll did the report, but now we're dealing with the implementation. So there will be lots of changes dealing with everything from registering deer to the deer management unit boundaries to county deer advisory councils kind of starting to call the shots. To crossbows being legal this year, to a division between public and private land in terms of, you know, it's kind of like you have to declare Trump when you're playing bridge. In this case, you've got to declare whether you're going to hunt on public land or private land and get an appropriate permit for that. The winter, of course, was tough on deer in the North Woods, so there are quite a few units where there'll be no antlerless harvest. Bottom line, lots of new stuff and lots of stuff going on. So what to do about that? Well, first of all, we mentioned this current edition, the August edition of Wisconsin Natural Resources Magazine. The lead article is What to Know Before You Go. Be ready for the deer hunt with this helpful guide to regulations changes. And they are laid out here along with season structure, the new units, and a host of other things. That's one reference. I think you can either get the magazine or find it online. In addition, the DNR has produced a facts document, which I think will be available at any of the service centers or, again, online. Mm-hmm. If you go on their website and search deer, you can get to that. The regulations booklets will be available shortly if they're not out already. And they are having a chat. They do these online chats occasionally, and there'll be one coming up on August 12th, next Tuesday. And the big date when antlerless permits will be going on sale will be Monday, August 18th. So there are lots of things mm-hmm. coming up quickly, so it would behoove any of the 600,000 or 700,000 people who hunt deer by one way or the other in Wisconsin to get on top of this and to do it very quickly.
Because it sounds like these changes are going to affect everyone who's
deer hunting. They will affect everyone who hunts deer, no matter how they hunt or where they hunt. There'll be some changes that they need to be aware of. And to avoid any last-minute heartache or missed opportunities for permits or whatever else, it's time to get started on that now.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for that. Let's go back to the phones and Julie, in Burlington. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Judith. Thank you guys for taking my call.
Sure.
I live about 2 blocks from Echo Lake in downtown Burlington, close to downtown Burlington. I have a 6-foot fence around my backyard, and I have a perennial garden with some native flowers and some other cultivated flowers. I have on all sides except to the south trees that are at least 50 feet tall and either overhang my yard or give me a great deal of shade. It's been a real haven for songbirds. And occasionally I have some feral cats that find shelter under my glass shop. And about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I noticed I have a new neighbor, a hawk. And he has pretty much, the squirrel circus has left town. I had a couple of chipmunks out there, and they are no longer here. My robins aren't there. The usual ruckus that I got from starlings when there was a cat that was prowling, that has disappeared. It's very quiet out there. And I am wondering, there the cat that had a batch brought in 3 kittens earlier this spring, and one of those kittens is gone. So he's hunting, I think, in this neighborhood because I've got paradise for wildlife here. So I did go and pick up an owl decoy. Is there anything else that I can do to discourage him? Everything in my garden now is probably about thigh high or higher, so there isn't a lot of clear space, and I don't have any lawn back there.
Okay.
So is there anything else I can do to discourage them?
All right. Thanks for that call, Julie.
Well, first of all, Julie, do you have any idea what kind of hawk it is? Have you gotten a look at it?
I have seen it. I saw it just before your program began, flying overhead and calling. It's not a very large hawk. I have not identified it. I haven't pulled the bird book out, but I don't think it's a red-shouldered hawk.
Does it have a fairly long, narrow tail or a short, broad tail?
I don't think it's a Eastern Harrier.
No, it's probably not either of those. It's most likely, if it's fairly small and has a longish tail, then it's Cooper's hawk. And if it's a big, heavy-bodied... Pardon?
It seems to be quite light-bodied, and it is white under.
Well, would you describe it as crow-sized or bigger?
Bigger than a crow.
Bigger than a crow. Then it's probably a red tail, which is very common around here. And if it's after squirrels and chipmunks and so forth, which a Cooper's hawk wouldn't mess with, then it's probably a red tail. And the reality of the situation is there's not a great deal you can do. If your yard and the surrounding environs provided an abundance of prey animals, which it sounds like it did, then the hawk was just gravitating to a good spot from a hawk's perspective. If the hawk has either been effective at driving these animals underground, so to speak, or staying out of sight, and also taken a few of them physically, then it will likely get to the point where the bird will decide to look for more fertile grounds, and it will leave on its own. And as we get more along toward cold weather, most of our red tails kind of move out and are replaced by rough legs from the north, and that's not likely that there'd be a one-for-one switch of birds in your backyard.
Right.
So there's really not very much you can do. I mean, you could put out some—I don't think the owl decoy is going to do much of anything— you could attempt to, you know, disturb the bird when you see it perching or on a hunting situation in your yard, but I think that's going to be a low, more frustration for you than anything else. And I don't think any kind of streamers or pinwheels or scare eye balloons or anything like that are really going to affect very much. So,
I think this is a case where
what's happened is a natural progression of what happened in your yard when you get an abundance of prey animals, and something's in there taking advantage of it. And there are probably other things there, too, that you don't even know about. So I think you kind of have to grit your teeth and bear it, and things will at some point change again, hopefully more in the direction you'd like to see.
All right. Thanks for that call, Julie. Let's go back to the phones, and Jan in Duluth is up next. Hi, Jan.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about a mink. And we live on the water in Duluth, on the St. Louis Bay, and we have some crushed or big blue stone along the edge of the water and a little garden along the edge of that. And I was weeding in my garden last year, and a mink popped up out of the rocks, came across to the plants, and bit me, and then ran back into the rocks again. And I've never heard of that before. I'm wondering, is that an unusual thing? And I'm also a little hesitant anymore to go out and weed in that area. Thinking,
I can understand that.
Is he going to come back?
Sure.
So do you have any advice for me? Should I be making lots of noise when I'm out there? Or
well, Jan, I want to tell you, if you want to come weed in my garden, I'm 99% sure there are no minks that are going to bite you, and there's plenty of weeding to be done.
Thank you. Can you guarantee no minks?
Well, riprap like that along the shoreline is a pretty common place for mink to hang out, either just, you know, hunting other things that are in all those cavities and crevices, or also a place where they might have a den. And my guess would be, first of all, it's very unusual for any wild animal to just, you know, rise up out of nowhere and rush over and bite a human. There's too much risk associated to the animal there. I'm assuming you were fairly startled by that bit of action on the mink's part, so there was no time to respond, but it's a pretty unusual event, and my best guess would be that it's related to the fact that that was Mrs. Mink, and the rest of the family was there amongst the rocks, and Mama Mink just decided, well, this weeding activity is just getting too close to the home rock pile here, and she took steps to change up the playing field. And it seems like her activity and decision was, from her standpoint, the right one at the time.
And quite effective.
Oh,
so,
yes.
You know, this was a while back, you said.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, last year.
Oh.
But I know there has been mink activity along the shoreline
this year. I mean, there will probably always be mink along the shoreline there, and it happens along the riprap here, along the university trail, going along campus along the shore of Lake Mendota. And being weasels, or members of the weasel family, they're very curious and inquisitive, and we've had cases where especially the young ones, will come right up along the shoreline and, you know, check somebody out, but not bite them. If you want to see if they're around or get a better look at them, mink as well as the smaller weasels are prone to responding to squeaking. Oh. So if you suck on the back of your hand and make a squeaking sound that they must interpret as a mouse or a rabbit in distress, just kind of a something like that, they'll not uncommon to have them pop out and come up and have a look. I remember on one occasion doing that along the lake trail where I knew the mink were, and pretty soon there was a young one kind of at each toe of my shoes looking up at me as though, what the heck is that kind of thing. So I don't think this will ever happen again. You might be the only recorded mink bite victim in the state in quite a long time, you know, unless you were provoking the animal or had it cornered or something like that.
Yeah,
but just an unprovoked attack, pretty darn unusual.
Okay,
so
good.
So you can go back to weeding.
That's good. I did have the rabies vaccine after it, but Yes, I hope it never happens again.
Well, thanks for sharing that story, Jim.
I think you can go back to your weeding, and at least for the first few bouts of weeding, I'd be tempted to carry something like a golf club or a short hoe or something just so you can fend off any mm-hmm. subsequent attacks.
Yeah. You know, but it happens so fast.
Right. Yeah, they're very quick.
If my husband hadn't been sitting there, I would have not been able to tell you I saw a streak of brown, and that was it.
Anyway,
well, thank you very much.
Thanks for sharing that story, Jen. You never know what we're going to hear when you're on the show, Scott.
That's an interesting story.
Well, I think we have another interesting story from Dave in Wausau, so let's go there next. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, was an appropriate lead into my story. I've been told this is the most unusual outdoor experience, woods experience, by all the great woodsmen I know in my life, and that it was very rare. I was at LaSalle Falls up near Florence, my brother and I and a friend, and we had decided that it was the perfect night to camp out under the stars. And so we laid a little tarp down in the midst of a field of ferns, or patch of ferns, and the sound of the falls and the campfire we had going were drowning out everything, so much so that when I was yelling at them because of this blood-curdling sound, I heard coming straight at me, while I had 1 foot and one arm in the mummy bag, so I was kind of in a straitjacket and couldn't do anything. they didn't hear me yelling, and I still don't know if they heard me, but they saw what I saw, which was the ferns parting in a beeline straight for me in the sleeping bag. And this was like a dying rabbit, or five dying rabbits.
Yeah.
And it scared the crap out of me.
I understand. It sounds reasonable. Okay.
And I'll bet you might be one of the only people that knows what it is right away, but sure enough, this ball of porcupine quills that was, I swear, 6 feet in diameter came out of those ferns. And by that time, they'd figured out what it was, and they had took chunks of firewood and were throwing it at it. And the ball split into two balls, and they both scurried off to a little ridge top we could see in the fire lot. And they took one last look at us and scurried off. And sure enough, we went there, and here's blood and porcupine quills. And my woodsman friend said they were probably fighting a territorial fight to the death. So I'm interested in your comments on it. It was a great experience, and I love telling the story. Thank you very much.
It's quite a mental picture.
That's quite a story. So you don't have any indication that these porcupines were coming for you. You just think you were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, I think so. He's gone now.
Okay. Well, porcupines are. Well, they're big fat rodents, and they're generally very slow moving and not given credit for a great deal of intelligence as humans think of intelligence. However, they have a really wide repertoire of sounds, including the young ones and females, just a mournful whining like abandoned puppies in the back of a car. Mm. And when the adults are squabbling over something, what they witnessed could have been breeding activity gone wrong. It could have been a territorial problem, or, you know, two males fighting over something else. But I think they were just in the path of a couple of porcupines in the midst of something. Mm-hmm. And that's what
the
happened.
The image of him stuck in his mummy
bag. I don't feel comfortable in a mummy bag anyway, but knowing there's something coming through the bushes right toward me, it would be very disconcerting.
Well, that's a great story. Thanks so much for sharing that. Let's go back to the phones, and Brian in Kenosha is up next. Hi, Brian.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Similar to a previous caller, I've got a critter digging under my front porch.
Uh-huh.
On the concrete slab next to my house there. It's dug about a 6-inch wide hole, a couple inches deep, and it's got all the rocks out that I guess were there from the beginning, and it's making its home in there. I'm wondering what I might have and what I can do about it.
So the hole the animal seems to be occupying is 6 inches or so in size, so probably not a chipmunk, ground squirrel, or some such thing. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Something
but,
bigger.
But you say the hole's only 2 inches deep? I mean, that's...
It only seems like it's a couple inches deep. I haven't got down there to actually put my hand in there to see or anything. But.
Well, it may be the start of an excavation that may go a lot deeper if the animal can do it, or it may have decided, hey, this is digging is tough going here, and it's relocated. But the most likely underdeck culprits, especially that are good excavators, a woodchuck or groundhog, same thing. They can do a tremendous amount of excavation. The hole is usually 6, 7, 8 inches in diameter, and they're not easily discouraged. The tactics, if it is a woodchuck, they can be caught in a live trap. Larry knows a lot about that. He had quite an experience with woodchucks a few years ago. They can be caught in a live trap, baited with fresh vegetables, and then removed from the scene. They can sometimes be discouraged from that particular spot with a good dose of moth flakes or naphthalene flakes, just simply a handful of them pitched into where it's digging. No mammals like that stuff. And the long-term solution for a porch or a deck, if animals are just a chronic nuisance under there, is to skirt the deck with, you know, either, depending on the distance from the deck to the ground, either with hardware cloth or a good quality lattice or chain link or whatever works so that you feel you can work with and find aesthetically pleasing. And then make sure that's trenched in enough so that no burrowing animals can get under there at all. But the most likely culprit is woodchuck. Skunk is also a possibility, but you'd likely, if you get down there and look around, you'd likely smell at least some sense that it's a skunk. And possum, probably not, and it's probably too much excavation for ground squirrels, chipmunks, and the like, or rats. So I'm going to go with woodchuck try those tactics we talked about.
All right. Good luck with that, Brian. Let's try to take a quick call in the last couple of minutes from Jackie in Milwaukee. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. If I'm right, you've got problems with mice, Scott, in the house. A lady called in on a program last week. I don't remember which one it was. But her problem was something else was outside. But she used Repels All and sprayed it on the ground under her car because the mice had been eating the wires.
Yes.
On her car.
Mm-hmm. That's fairly common, especially in stored vehicles over the winter, whether it's a car or a boat or some other mechanical device. So when I put my boats and things away for the winter, I normally put place packs of rodenticide and some traps in all such conveyances to try and guard against that.
My young friend's husband won't let her use traps or any kind of poison, but she's going to try this because the woman said that she hasn't had any problem. She doesn't spray it on the car.
Mm-hmm.
Sprays it on the ground.
Well, I mean, they've got to obviously cross that area to jump up into the engine compartment or whatnot. So that, and I've had people make little, like a spice bag out of naphthalene or moth flakes and just use a twist tie to attach those to various places in the engine compartment, too. Whatever kinds of repellents they can come up with that might help.
All right. Thanks for that, Jackie. And very quickly, Scott, Kathleen posted some really cool pictures on the Facebook page. People who want to see it, go to the left-hand column posts to page. It's not totally evident where those are, but several photos of about a 1.5-inch long skull. And you said it is.
A mole skull.
A mole skull, but very interesting. She's got some great different angles on
that. They're very flat, and they have a very large brain cage. And you can see the teeth, that one's lost a lot of teeth, but the teeth are pretty impressive for an animal that's not much bigger than your index finger.
Well, thanks for bringing your large brain case to the show today.
Thank you very much.
We really appreciate it. Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Specialist with the UW Extension. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer today. Thanks to him for all his help. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned.